going on there, Rick, huh?
Hey, everyone. Yeah.
What's happening? Welcome to the Drummers Education Connection. We are thrilled to be here today. My name is Jeremy Steinkohler, and I'm with my dear friends, amazing drummers and educators, Bart Robley down in Southern California, Rick Stojak in San Diego. And today we are honored to have one of my all-time drumming heroes on the show as a guest, who's generously sharing his time with us and tell us all about his experience and share his wisdom. Please welcome David Garibaldi. Yeah.
DG.
For those of you, awesome. With you guys. Yeah, great to be with you guys.
Oh, it's our pleasure. For those of you who have been living under a rock for the last 25 years, David is the drummer with the band The Tower of Power, the seminal funk band from Oakland, my hometown, and where I live now. And he's also one of Hudson Music's best-selling authors. He's written several books. We're going to talk about that. He's done projects. In addition to playing with Tower of Power, some of you may not know, he's also played with Patty Austin, Natalie Cole, Yellow Jackets, Jermaine Jackson, Gino Vannelli. So he's been busy and done all sorts of things. He's got his drumsticks and all different kinds of pots. and I should mention, David is also endorses Sabian Cymbals, Yamaha Drums, Vic Firth, Latin Percussion, Audix, and Remo. And we'll let him on the show, in spite of the fact that he's a Remo guy. I'm just teasing.
Wow, you guys are hardcore, man.
Yeah, right. So, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Anyway, David, let's start at the beginning, man. I want to hear, we ask our guests, especially those who've reached some level of notoriety with their drumming, how things got started for them, because it's always great for our students and our community to hear that everybody starts out kind of the same, like a beginner. And you know, so tell us about how you got started playing drums and the arc of your story a little bit.
Well, I began playing drums when I was 10 years old, school band program. I started a couple of years before that. I was 8 years old, and the band teacher comes around to all the classrooms and he says, who wants to be in the band? Of course, everybody, you know, raises their hand. They want to do it. And I want to play trumpet. And so I've always loved trumpet, you know, players of all different types. And so, when it came around the time for me to pick my instrument, I said, I want to play the trumpet. He says, well, there's no trumpets left. You have to play the violin. So they gave me this violin. I'm serious. And it just really sucked. I mean, sorry for, you know, violin players, but for me, that didn't do it. I wanted to be a trumpet player. So I just wasn't interested then at that point, and, you know, kind of let it go after the violin, you know, escapade. And a little while after that, I think a couple of years later, I got the idea that I wanted to play drums. My parents used to play music and, you know, at home all the time. And there was something called the saber dance. They used to play that, you know, and it has all this percussion, classical percussion stuff in it. And so it just gave me the idea to want to play drums. So I asked the school band teacher, could I be in the band? I want to play drums. And he said, of course, you know, come on in. So that's when it started, and I just kept it going, you know, all through school and that sort of thing. I was in military music program. I was in the band, Air Force band. Did some college. I never graduated college because I was too busy playing in bands and that sort of thing. And I never, at that point in my life, I didn't like school that much. I wasn't a very good student. I just wanted to screw around and, you know, do stuff like every, you know, a lot of other people. Mm-hmm. And so when I got, I guess, after my first year or so with Tower, I joined Tower when I was 23. And not long after that, I had met this guy here in the Bay Area. His name was Steve Bowman. And he played with a band called AUM, A-U-M. And we used to do shows with them when I first started with Tower. We'd do shows with them. And he started taking private lessons with a guy here in the Bay Area named Chuck Brown. Mm. He used to have a studio downtown Oakland, above Sherman and Clay upstairs. Mm-hmm. And he had another studio over in San Rafael, over in, you know, Marin County.
Yeah.
But he'd come over here, and a lot of guys were studying with him. And so Steve used to tell me, he says, man, you should study with this guy, man. I think you'd really like it, you know. And I wasn't into that at all at the time. All I wanted to do is tour with my band, and just kind of mess around. And I noticed that over time that he was getting better.
Mm.
And it started to kind of, you know, you hear footsteps, you know, and I'm starting to get nervous. And, you know, my ego couldn't handle him getting better. And so I woke up one morning and I felt shame because I wasn't demonstrating to people what I was telling everybody was my life's work. And I wasn't showing that to anyone. So I called up my friend Steve and I said, give me the guy's number. And I began studying with him, and that completely changed everything for me. I learned all about discipline. He was an old school young guy with old school values for teaching. And he was just a fabulous, fabulous teacher. Taught me all about the discipline of learning. And it changed everything about my music life. You know, then I became...
What did he take you through, David? Like, I mean, back then, I mean, was it, did you go through stick control, syncopation? What did you work on?
Well, syncopation wasn't really part of the equation in those days. I hate to sound like I just stepped off the covered wagon or something. It was kind of a different deal, you know? So we did stick control, the Louis Belson reading books, you know, reading text in 4/4 and odd time. And a lot of hand technique stuff. That was kind of a big focus for him. And then basic jazz technique, you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
And seeing as how, you know, I was already kind of in a band where I was kind of creating, you know, beats and all this other thing, kind of, you know, wanted to be myself. He was kind of the perfect guy because he was sort of this renegade, you know, sort of guy. He had studied in Boston with, you know, Alan Dawson and all kinds of stuff, you know. So he was a fabulous, fabulous teacher, but a renegade. So that was perfect for me because that was kind of how I viewed everything. And, of course, here in the Bay Area, everything was like that anyway. You know, everybody wanted to be themselves. And so it was just kind of cool, you know. So I got into his hand technique stuff. Started a practice journal, you know, and all this. And it was wonderful. You know, I bought into his thing totally, you know.
I've had a few students come to me over the years who had taken some lessons with Chuck, and man, their hands were in amazing shape. So that doesn't surprise me to hear. Hey, you mentioned Steve Bowman. Is that the same Steve Bowman that was the original drummer in the Counting Crows?
Oh, I don't know about that.
Because I have there's a Bay Area guy, drummer Steve Bowman. He moved to Nashville, but he was a good friend of mine. And
Steve lives in Arizona.
Okay, different guy.
He lives in Arizona. I think it's a different Steve Bowman. Yeah, but he was he also worked in over at Don Weir's Music City, which was one of the kind of like ground zero music store here in the Bay Area, over in San Francisco on Columbus Avenue. And everybody used to go in there and hang out and buy gear and all this other stuff. And, you know, one of the guys in there, Reese Marin, he moved up to Seattle and started American Music up there. And, you know, it was just cool, you know, cool place.
That's
Dave,
awesome.
How did he help you in those lessons with the discipline of learning? You said that you had a journal. Were there other techniques that he worked on for discipline and practicing?
I mean, his thing was just, he'd give you kind of a basic thing, like for instance, like with stick control, we would start with one stroke equals one click of the metronome. And we start very, very slow. And you go up the metronome that way, and then back down as eighth notes, you know, up again, back down, and up again as 16th notes. And it was a whole system that he had. And we spent a lot of time on the first pages of stick control, pages 5, 6, and 7.
Right.
And that was the kind of like the for me, the focus of the hand technique was that stick control. Yes, absolutely. And it was wonderful stuff. And so he would give you maybe 4 or 5 exercises at a time, and you were to practice these exercises for 5 minutes without stopping.
Mm.
And mm-hmm. so if you ah. if he gave you like five exercises, there's like a 25 minute routine. Mm-hmm. And yes. so you had, this was continuous. And so
yes.
when I first started with doing that, I couldn't concentrate. So his whole thing mm-hmm. was, if you feel any tension or you screw up, the clock starts again.
Mm. Wow.
The idea was to learn how to relax mm-hmm. and focus. And so the practice pad, he had this thing with practice pads, and he would have to build your own practice pad. He'd tell you where to go, Macbeth Hardware over there on Ashby and Berkeley. Oh. And wow. you have to go to this art store and you get this little rubber thing. And then, you would cut out a 25-cent piece and you would glue it to the top of this little wood block and attach it to a stand. And it was a whole project that you had to do. And that's the kind of the first thing that he would get you into, was building your own practice pad, which wow. I would, wow. I became married to that thing. I took it with me. I'd take it on airplanes all over the place. I still have it. I have it, stashed away, in a storage unit.
That's like that build your own teddy bear place that they have at Disney.
build a bear.
Right. So like really a tiny little playing surface that you have to be super accurate with.
Yeah. And so, the whole thing was about relaxation and accuracy. And I'm going, you want me to, do all these exercises on that? And he said, yes, absolutely. So, but ooh. After a while, your accuracy became really super fine tuned. And what I noticed was on my drums, I was, even though I was playing on this pad and then I would play on my snare drum, and the exercise on the snare drum, I was wearing a little hole or a worn spot on the center of each head.
Wow.
So it was teaching me about accuracy on all the playing surfaces. So he would have a special place on the cymbal where he would want you to play. And so you can get a better sound out of the cymbal and all this stuff. He taught me all about the places on the cymbal where, you can play to produce different sounds. I never thought of any of these things before,
Right.
And it was just a really fabulous experience with him, in all ways, very old school. So if you didn't have your lesson prepared, he'd throw you out.
Would he really?
Oh,
really?
Wow.
Yeah, I've heard that about Vic Firth.
Yeah, I studied with Murray Spivak in Los Angeles too, and he was the same way.
Yeah.
If you didn't come prepared, out.
Don't bother. Right.
I've heard that about Vic Firth was that way. I heard that Vic Firth was that way, that you would show up to your lesson, and if you weren't prepared, see you next week.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's all my teachers were like that. I mean, that was very common, mm-hmm. common thing, you either into it or you're not. Don't waste my time.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Hey, Dave, would you still have to pay for the lesson?
Of course. What do you think?
I'm going to have every one of my students watch this segment.
Well, it's different today. You aren't really hardcore with people because everybody gets insulted and all this other stuff. When I taught at the Dick Grove School, if guys weren't prepared, I'd send them out of the class. Because guys would come to the Dick Grove School. That's when I was living in Los Angeles. I taught there for like 9 years, and mm-hmm. I'd have all these young guys coming in to study. And I would, the first thing I always ask everybody, the very first day that people study with me is, what is it that you want to do? What do you want to accomplish? And everybody, of course, they would say, well, I want to get into studios and this and that. And then you hear them play, and all they can play is the very raw rock and roll kind of stuff, not good readers and all that stuff. So I would explain to them, I'm your competition. You're coming in here into this town. Right. I'm your competition. Mm-hmm. And then I would explain to them all the things that are necessary in this town if you want to work in the studios like you say you would like to do. You have guys, John Robinson, there was mm-hmm. all kind of other guys. That was Jeff Porcaro was alive, mm-hmm. there was tons of guys. Steve Schaefer was another one, Ralph Humphrey. I mean, these guys were like supremely skilled, you know, Ndugu Chancellor, you know, Earl Palmer, you know, these guys, supremely skilled and unique skill sets for the recording studio, for all the stuff that they did, you know, movies, TV, jingles, you know, all of that stuff, you know, was really interesting to be in that environment, you know.
I bet. Now, when you taught there and you would ask that question, okay, and then you would say, I'm your competition. I'm the guy that, you know, is your competition. Or the names you threw out there, Picaro, Ralph Humphrey. I studied with Ralph as a side note. Would you see people, would most of them rise to the occasion, or would a lot of them crumble and fall away?
Well, you know, it's, you just have to make a decision. I mean, drumming is so much more than paradiddles, you know. You have to make a decision as to what it is that you want to do. And then you set about the process of doing it, you know. And not everyone understands that. Not everyone is willing to put in the time to get, you know, to realize a dream, you know.
Right. Right. I think that that's the... I saw an interview with, it was a conversation really between Weckl and Vinnie Kaliuta, and they were talking about their left hand technique and how everybody wants to do what you say, play studios and do tours and stuff like that. And the most common question they would get is, you know, what does it take to get there? And the answer is like, you have no idea what it takes. It just, you know, the amount of time that it takes just with that stick in your hand is unbelievable. And
you see these videos of these guys that they're who's the guy from Brazil?
Ramon Montagnier.
Ramon. Yeah, that guy.
Alex.
Yeah. Oh, he was on the show.
Okay. So you look at somebody like him who has incredible facility with his hands, you know. How much time do you think it takes to be able to do that? You know, that's hours and hours and hours and hours. Thomas Lang. I remember seeing him when he came to a NAMM show, and it was really the first time that anybody had really seen him play, you know, on kind of any kind of major level. And here, this guy's doing five-stroke rolls with his feet, you know, ostinatos and play soloing over these ostinatos and stuff. And, you know, the amount of work that it takes to be able to do that is astounding. You know, the hours that it takes. And he was already, you know, an old kind of older than a lot of guys, because he had, of course, nobody knew about him. And he's, you see all the years that he spent working, right? Mm-hmm. Just absolutely stunning, you know, to see that sort of stuff, you know.
Yeah, it is a huge, huge, huge commitment. And I think a big labor of love, you know, I mean, because not everybody's going to get to the level of notoriety that, you know, those people that you mentioned. It's, you have to really love it if you want to do that, you know.
Well, it's just a commitment, you know.
Yeah.
You know, a motivation is not this weird thing that, you know, an ethereal concept. It's something that you do, and it's a decision, you know. You can choose kind of how you want to do this. It's all about choice, really.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you decide that this is what you want to do, and then you set about the task of getting it done, you know. And so you learn a lot about yourself. You learn a lot about, you know, your ability to withstand pressures and, you know, your ability to sustain efforts and, you know, all these things, you know, that go into, and it's no different than any other profession that requires a high degree of skill. You know, they learn in the, you know, in the same way. You know, I have a friend who's a doctor, you know, he's a retired surgeon, and we would work together and, you know, explain to him, you know, you have to create with all these things that we learn. And it was the same thing with him when he's in surgery. I'm saying, you're not consulting a manual or looking at a method book while you're doing that, right? You understand what you're doing, and then you're creating a solution for the situation, right? Mm-hmm. And it's the same thing that you do when you play music, you know. So was it Mark Twain says, don't let school get in the way of your education?
Yeah. I mean, very well. Yeah.
That's a brilliant statement, you know.
Man,
there's a lot of people I think that are under the notion that like, you know, technique is sort of for a certain kind of drummer, and you know, they're just a feel player. I get people, sometimes students come in and say, I'm more of a feel player. You know, I don't really want to work on, you know, this aspect of my stroke or, you know, controlling the height, you know, on my accent rebounds or whatnot. And David, I know I've had a couple of students who've taken some lessons with you and worked out of your book, your amazing book, Future Sounds, which I use in my teaching practice all the time. And I want to ask you about that. But I know you're a stickler for stroke height and having that being an important ingredient to developing your feel.
Well, I mean, look at all the guys that we listen to. Watch what they do. How do they get the sound that they get? You know? It's an organized sort of a deal. I didn't invent any of this. All I did was just, you know, write it down on paper and said, you know, here's what I see, you know, and, you know, when I did what I saw them doing, I got the same result. I got, I got the same sound, you know, all the drummers that we've talked about today, they all do that. And, you know, you can say that you're a feel player. What does that mean? You know, when you're feeling around, do you really know what you're doing when you're feeling around? You know, it makes me think you're in the dark without a flashlight, you know?
Right. And well, so even to produce a feel of whatever that style you're playing, you've got to, you know, physically, technically produce something that comes out of your hands or your feet.
Right? Okay. Let's talk about that for a second.
Yes, please.
One of the definitions of technique is a method of procedure. How many methods of procedure are there? It's countless. It's endless.
Yeah, yeah, it is. It is countless. Yeah.
And so you're talking about developing system or systems to use when you play. Mm-hmm. And everyone has to do it. Everyone has a technique,
right?
Whether it's something they've put together on their own or whatever, it's a system, it's still a technique, right? And so I think, you know, you're developing language skills, right? So, you know, if you want to if you want to have better language skills, then you study language so that you can communicate your thoughts more effectively. You know, you widen your vocabulary so that you can communicate yourself and you don't, you know, sound like an uneducated ding dong when you're trying to explain yourself. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing when we play. You know, we want to play as articulately as we can. Mm-hmm. And so I think that requires some sort of investigation, some sort of, you know, study.
Absolutely. But very well said.
Yes.
Dave, I've seen you play with Tower of Power here in San Diego many times, and it's just a big giant groove fest. The groove is just so damn infectious. And what I marvel at is it's complicated sounding. It's not just simple 2 and 4 and the audience gets it, you know? And I always marvel because I'm like, uh-oh, I can't find 1 for a second. And so, you know, it might be like a novice question, but how do you guys do that? Is there a lot of polyrhythms? Is there a lot of odd times? Are they in 4 and you're just playing over the bar line? So could you tell us a little bit how you come up with all this stuff?
Well, first of all, Tower of Power music is 4-4 all the way. I mean, it's just phrasing, you know, really. Yep. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when you hear us, when you hear us play, I mean, you hear people playing together. And I think that's what music is, you know, it's like learning how to play together, listening. You know, I did a clinic once with a bunch of Yamaha guys, with Randy Brecker and Dave Samuels and all these guys. And you know, it was so fun and so cool. And we were doing it for high school kids in Santa Barbara. So one of the questions that we got in the afternoon was, you know, what would be the most important thing that you'd want us to take from the day, you know? And Randy was talking, and they were, you know, asking him these questions. And he said, he kind of thought about it for a second. He said, well, you know, to listen, learn how to listen. Mm-hmm. And if you really, if you think about that, you know, if you think of music as a conversation, what's the most important element in conversation? It's not the talking, it's the listening.
Yes.
Because if you listen, then you know how to respond.
Yes.
Right? Just like we're doing, like right now, we're having, this is a jazz concert right now, what we're having. We're listening to each other, right? We're listening to each other and we're responding to each other. So Rick, with regard to your, you know, your questions and stuff, if you ever gone to listen to Latin music, you listen to Cuban music where there's clave involved and there's no big banging out 2 and 4 or any of those other stuff, you know, Tower of Power is like, it's kind of like that, really. It's just a flow of the music, and you know, from the downbeat, the initial downbeat to the last note played in the concert, it's just this flow of ideas and flow of stuff. You know, that's kind of how we do it. You know, we change it up all the time. You know, people ask me, you know, man, aren't you sick and tired of playing those songs, man? I mean, how many times can you do that? I said, well, I can do it a lot. You know, our music, we're getting paid to do it.
Yeah.
And it's fun. And nobody's telling us what to do. We're just kind of like making it up as we go along. So the arrangements change all the time. You know, it's just a fluid, you know, sort of a deal, you know?
I think I would imagine that you would still find it challenging as well, no?
Hell yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Oh, man, yeah. Well, I saw a quote with Charlie Watts one time, you know, and that was what he said. He goes, you know, even after all these years of playing the drums, I love it. And I still find it challenging every day. And when you speak about listening, a lot of times people, you know, they talk about drummers, sometimes younger drummers, they'll talk about Ringo and Charlie Watts and they'll be like, oh, that stuff's so simple. And I'm just like, man, you don't get it. It's that whole vibe that those guys brought to that music. And they're, once again, their feel, you know, doesn't matter how complicated it is. It's in the touch and their voice on the instrument. You know, it has nothing to do with, you know, playing over the bar line or polyrhythms, like Rick said. You know, it's their voice on the instrument.
Well, it's their, you know, also, you know, their intent. You know, and so
yes,
you know, the vibe that you project when you play.
Thank you.
You know, that kind of like comes out. You know, you know. Man, you listen to Charlie Watts. I mean, that's a vibe, man.
Totally,
You know, and it's the same vibe I get when I listen to Tony Williams. You know, I listen to Maiden Voyage, right?
Yeah.
And to me, that has just dripping with vibe, and it's you know, so cool, such a great, great kind of, you know, thematic, you know, cinematic thing, you know. It's just, I love listening to that, and its intent. All the great bands, they have a vibe, its intent. So when you come to see a Tower of Power show, you know, that's what you're getting. You know, you're getting a vibe. You know, people enjoy each other, and so I believe that communicates in the music.
It does
make sure that we get along, you know, we're a family, you know, we're same family stuff that happens to everybody, but we love each other. We still do all the dysfunctional shit like everybody else does.
Ain't it the truth? You know,
but we still enjoy each other, and it's still really, really fun. And I believe that gets projected, you know, from the stage when we play, you know, our connection to each other, our connection to what we do, you know.
And it streams right to the audience because it, like I said, it's a groove fest, and it sounds like you guys have always done it your way. Has there ever been a period in the band's history where you had record industry pressure to be something that you're not, to do some like goofy, silly disco song?
Good question.
Absolutely so.
Yeah. How did you guys deal with that?
What'd you do?
Well, I think that, you know, those times were kind of difficult. You know, that was when the band also was having a lot of, you know, abuse, substance abuse problems and this kind of stuff, you know. And so it was like just a whole weird thing, you know, that was kind of going on, you know. But it's just stuff that happened and whatever. So you deal with it. Move on.
Okay. Yeah. So I would be remiss as a drummer and a drum educator if I didn't ask this question, I think. So, you know, linear drumming and your vibe, right, that you're talking about. How did that come to be? Because when I listen to you play, you know, I mean, there's that moment as a drummer. I remember the first time I heard What Is Hip. I'm like, what the hell's he doing?
What is that?
Yeah. You know, what is that? What is that, like 20 overdubs? What is that? You know, and then you realize what it is. How did that come to be for you? How did that? Because I mean, that, like you're saying, that's your fingerprint. How did you get that?
Well, when I was, you know, learning how to play, and I'd listen to my favorite guys, I noticed that they all had a personality in their playing that was, you know, recognizable. I mean, this is like before, you know, there was video that you could check out and watch people play.
Right.
You know, there was like, it was just needle drop stuff, you know, and you listen to drummers play and you knew it was them by listening, just by the sound that was coming out. And I wanted that sort of personality, you know, in my playing. And, you know, being here in the Bay Area, that was the perfect place for it, because at the time, everybody was trying to be themselves and, you know, not copy and all these other things, you know. Mm-hmm. And so when I started with Tower, it was an opportunity for me to really develop my voice, because no one was telling me what to do. Not one person. Wow. You know, everybody, Emilio was, you know, the leader, Mimi, you know, we call him Mimi. You know, he was my advocate. He loved drums and he wanted it to be different. When I first heard Tower, they were doing, you know, original music that had a real cool vibe, and then really obscure cover songs that you'd only know about if you were a musician. And they were like doing these covers and they were arranging them in their own way. And I'm thinking, man, this is pretty badass, you know? So when I had the opportunity to join the band, I mean, it was an opportunity to really get in and develop things, you know? And so that's how it went. And I was listening a lot to Bernard Purdy, to Zigbo, you know, to, you know, Sonny Payne with Count Basie, Jake Hanna with the Woody Herman Band. You know,
oh, I can hear that. Yeah.
Greg Errico, you know, all these guys. And so then I started listening to Latin music. And, you know, when I started listening to Latin music, that's when I realized that you could have grooves without any sort of 2 and 4 going. You know, you could just create rhythms and have those rhythms be the beats in the songs, you know?
Yes.
And when we discovered that that worked, that sort of changed, you know, kind of changed everything, you know, like for me. Then I could really build. I wasn't limited by having a 2 and 4 or any kind of structure. I could just build whatever I wanted and be influenced by anything and just fit it into the music. So I got into this thing where it was kind of, the parts were sort of layered. I was listening to Purdy and I was noticing, I was hearing all these levels of things in his play. And I would go through songs and I would try to pick out only the hi-hat parts.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would go back and I'd listen to see if I could pick out all the snare drum notes, the ghosted notes and, you know, accents and how he put them all together. And then same with the bass drum. I listened to all the voices separately, try to anyway.
Mm.
And what I heard was something that sounded really layered. It was all these rhythms on top of one another. And so that kind of like was what the What Is Hip thing was all about in that, you know, period of time. Then our first trip to Boston, I met Casey Sherrill and Doug Florence, who were going to Berkeley at the time. And they took me to meet Alan Dawson and Gary Chafee. And Gary Chafee was teaching a polyrhythms class at Berkeley at the time. And he was also in the faculty ensemble. So he wanted the faculty ensemble, that was like Dave Samuels and Pat Metheny and some other guys, he wanted them to hear what I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
So we went in this room at Berkeley and played. And these guys are standing around watching me play, look like they had, you know, like freaking lab coats on or something. And was, you know, I mean, it was really funny, you know. And Gary just wanted them to hear what I was doing. Mm-hmm. And so Gary and I became really friendly and hang out and play and that stuff. And Gary was the first guy who coined the term linear, at least that I know of. Okay. So it was kind of like the two styles were like layered and linear. And Gary's thing was linear. It was like a flute or an instrument, a non-chordal instrument, right? That was like one line. And he felt that that for him worked better because it wasn't as dense. There was a lot of density in my playing because of all the layering rhythms on top of one another. And so with Gary, his thing was the linear approach. And so things then became for people learning was linear and layered. It was these two things, right? Linear is just really one aspect of drumming. So for instance, if you take hi-hat and snare drum, you play those together, that's layered. You play them separately. So if I play a flam or unison, that's layered. If I play 2/16th notes, that's linear.
Right.
And so all these rhythms are just that we play are a combination. Everybody does it. A combination of layered and linear phrases. Every time you hit a cymbal crash with your bass drum, that's a layered thing. You know, if you play the cymbal by itself or the bass drum by itself, it's linear. And then you put all those things together to create phrases, lines, grooves, you know, whatever, you know, solo ideas, all sorts of stuff, you know.
Very cool.
David, can you talk about the King Kong beat? I know I've watched a couple of videos of you talking about it and how that was an important piece of the puzzle for you.
It was, because I was playing kind of like all 16th notes with my right hand. You know, that's kind of like the approach that I took, you know, when I first started with Tower, that's kind of where I was at. And then I was playing continuous 16th notes with my right hand. And then underneath it was, you know, all of the, you know, the combinations with, you know, a bass drum and snare. And so then I saw Zig play. And I noticed that his thing was way more broken up. You know, all the voices were split up in really weird kind of ways. And there was really nobody kind of doing that stuff. Then I heard Clyde Stubblefield, you know, and his thing was really broken up. You know, 1968, I got the feeling, you know, James Brown, you know, that was like super, super, you know, like ahead of its time. And then I heard Pete DePoe, who was playing with a band called Redbone, and they had this song called Prehistoric Rhythm, and the lyric was the prehistoric rhythm with the King Kong beat. And the King Kong was this rhythm that he would play on the bell of his cymbal, dink, di dink, di dink, dink, di dink, di dink, like so. And then he would build rhythms around that. Well, over time, I learned to, you know, I learned that rhythm was it all throughout, you know, Afro-Cuban music and Puerto Rican music. You know, they call it cinquillo. It's five notes, and you know, it's like there's clave in it, basically. You know, it's or sort of a rhythm that you could play over clave. And so it was kind of like a really ear-opening, mind-opening thing for me. And I just started to realize, well, I can build stuff off of this. So I started fooling around with that and building beats from that. And so that was, you know, What Is Hip was one of the first ones where I did that. And Soul Vaccination has got that kind of idea in it, you know, basically. You know, that kind of thing. And I was like getting into rudiments and, you know, understanding rudiments and how the hands are, when you separate the hands on, play the hands on two different surfaces, they create all these different little weird rhythm things. And so all I did was just take those things and apply them and add weird accents to them and it turned into beats and stuff that I would use with, you know, with Tower, you know. So for me, like, no idea was off the table. I mean, I think, you know, any idea in the right context works. And so, mm-hmm. you know, if you have that sort of thinking about your playing, then everything just is very wide open, you know.
This is a perfect segue, I think, into talking about future sounds a little bit. I've used that book. I went through that book. I still practice out of it, and I see my students through it as well. And for me, it was like a complete ear opener. You know, like it changed the way I started thinking about funk grooves and considering how grooves could be played without that sort of standard pillar of the backbeat. And it opened up my right hand all over the place. So, like, I was just like you. I was doing eighths and sixteenths or a regular pattern, and all of a sudden this was like nothing I'd ever seen. But it opened my ears as much as it opened my hands and feet. Did you write the book like this is stuff that I do. This is my concept here. I'm sharing it with the drumming community. Or did you sort of like think about the book as, I don't know, something out of your head instead of out of your playing that you just wanted to put on paper? I don't know if I'm articulating the question very well, but I guess I'm wondering, like, how much of your playing is in the book, or is it just more like a theoretical exercise kind of thing?
No, there's nothing theoretical about it. I mean, you know, the pillar, if there is one, mm-hmm. it's not a voice, it's time.
Mm-hmm.
And so if that removes everything, puts it in one place, time, and that you're creating, you know, rhythms with time. You're using time and doing all sorts of different things with it, you know. So the book, that was all stuff that I was doing. I mean, you know, I don't know how to describe it. I mean, when you write a book, you get an idea and then you start putting things together. You know, I've never written a literary, you know, work, but I would imagine it's the same sort of deal. You get an idea and you're telling your story. And so with Future Sounds, I had put together a pretty sizable bunch of material that I was calling a book. And it was everything I thought about drumming. And I was sending it around to different people, and I didn't really know what to do with it. I wanted to do a book. I had wanted to do one, man, since I knew you could do something like that. I always thought it would be the coolest thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but I had this work, and I had no idea what to do with it. And then I had heard of Sandy Feldstein, who was, you know, one of the great music publishing guys, you know, at the time. Pretty historical figure in music publishing. And he was at Alfred Publishing in Los Angeles. And so I called him, see if I could meet with him. I mean, I was just trying everything. You know, I just wanted to get it out there somehow. So I called him and he said, yeah, come in. We'll meet, you know, come, you know. So we arranged a time. I went to his office. I took my book in there. He was a really cool guy. I mean, he was a college professor, taught at Potsdam University, you know, had percussion degrees and all this other stuff, you know, very educated, but also very, very smart with music marketing and all this stuff, and, you know, in the publishing world. He was an amazing, amazing person with unique talent. And so he took my book home and he said that he graded it like a college paper.
Oh, wow.
He looked at it like
that's cool.
Like a work that I was doing for a class, you know. And so we met again and he says, man, I love this. This is really, really fantastic. But, and then, of course, you know, he says, but you know what that means.
Edit.
Yeah. So he says, but you don't have a subject. And I'm going, what?
Damn it.
My subject is drums. You know, writing about the drums. And he says, yeah, but, you know, you have to come up with a part of the, you know, this work that is going to be kind of your theme.
Right.
And then save the rest for later. Mm-hmm. We'll do other books with it. So he says, oh, God. So I went home. That was my assignment. He says, come back when you get it figured out. So that took a couple weeks. And then I realized, I had the realization, well, wow, the thing that I really dig is beats. That's the thing I like the most. That was the thing that attracted me with Tower Powers, you know, that I could do that, you know. And then, because, of course, having gone seen James Brown, you know, when I was a teenager, and that completely changed my life. And, you know, I realized that's what I wanted to do. Right. You know, I think, okay, this is it. The beats, you know, hi-hat, snare drum, and bass drum. So I went back. And we met again. I told him that this is what I think it should be. And he held out his hand, shook hands. He said, let's get to work, you know. And the cool thing about Sandy was he knew what he wanted you to do, but would never say it because he wanted you to figure it out.
Oh, that's cool. That's cool.
He would ask you questions so that you would think, but he would never in all the work that I did with him, we did videos, we did books, all kinds of different stuff. Not once did he tell me what to do. He would always ask me questions that would make me think.
Right.
And then I would come up with the answer. And the answer was always what he knew I should be doing.
The Socratic method.
Yeah. I mean,
well, I think that's incredible. A wonderful way to teach. Yeah. I think that's a great way to teach drum students. You know, you get the gears going, you know, so you're not feeding them the answers and then they have to, yeah. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but that's
no.
That's brilliant. I love that. I love that.
I think, you know, studying is discovery, you know, yeah. And if you take discovery out of it, then you're, what are you really teaching? You know, I don't want people to play like me.
Right.
Right.
I absolutely don't want them to play like me at all. I want them to play like themselves. Mm-hmm. And if my books can maybe open that up or using other materials,
right.
But you know, the thing is that you want to create with what you learn, you know, that's that Mark Twain thing, you know, don't let school get in the way of your education. You know, you're not going to take a page of exercises to your gig.
Right. Yeah.
You're not, the guy's going to call a tune. You're going to go, wait a minute, I got to get my method book out. You're not doing that, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you take concept to your gig. Mm-hmm. That's what you take.
Yeah.
And, you know, your study allows you to create a solution for the musical problem that you have, that you have in front of you. You know, you want to get through the tune. You want to be able to have enough vocabulary to make it sound cool, you know? And if you have to play do some soloing or you know, it's your time to do something, you have to create.
Right.
And how do you do that? You study, right? And then you use what you study. One of the things I do, here's a thing I do with my students that really is very powerful is, well, one of the first things I ask is, you know, what kind of books are you studying? And, you know, I get a sense of kind of where people are at. And if people are really married to their books and married to rules, then I make them put all that away and we start a notebook. And the notebook, the assignment is, I want you to write down 12 ideas that you have. Write them down in as much detail as you can. And then in our next session, I want you to teach these things to me.
I love that.
Yeah, that's awesome.
I mean, it really works. And it's very, very powerful because, you know, people, it's difficult to do because people sometimes say, well, I don't have enough in me to do this. Well, you'd be surprised, you know.
Yeah.
It's like, writing an essay at school.
Mm-hmm. You
know? It's like that, you know.
I love that.
You know, you get an assignment, you know, write an essay about a dinner that you had with some friends. There's what you have to write about. And then you have to write this essay. And so the thing is here is I want to see where you're at. I want you to see where you're at. I want you to understand what's in you. And then we craft a way forward so that you can use the things that you're learning. So after we do that a couple times, then we get into maybe some pages of future sounds or some related materials or whatever, you know, another page of ideas, right? And then that's becomes part of the assignment. But the writing of the ideas, that always, that stays as like a basic component of the study so that you learn to develop, you know, like a voice and develop a belief that, you know, you have something in you that you can use. That's you.
Mm-hmm.
That's hugely important because I think the one thing that I speak for my drum students and myself and for every musician on the planet sometimes I think is pulling that confidence out, you know, knowing that you, what you have matters, you know, because a lot of people I think don't realize that, you know, they look to like you're the teacher, so you have all the answers, but you have to, you have some within yourself too. I think that's brilliant. Is that kind of what I'm hearing you say?
Well, my job is not to have all the answers,
right? You know,
it's really not. I mean, yeah, you know, my job is to show you that there are possibilities, you know, and that there are ways that you can, you know, develop for yourself some, you know, maybe you can discover for yourself that I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's all about discovering a path forward for yourself. And it's all about creating. What we do is art, no more, no less.
Yes.
You turned it into a series of rules.
Yep.
Then you're defeating what the whole thing is. And, you know, if you listen to Elvin Jones, you listen to, you know, like Max Roach, Tony Williams, you know, Greg Errico, you know, Stick People, all those guys that I hang with, you know, Mike Clark, Lenny White, you know, Michael Shreve, those guys, that's not rule. When I look at them, I don't see rules.
Right.
I see art. I see guys that are very unique in the way that they have approached, you know, their art, and they have a singular kind of a voice.
Right.
You know, and each one of us, all four of us here have that going for us. You know, we're unique individuals with a unique individual way of doing things, just like our handwriting. It's the same thing. As hard as I might try, my handwriting is my handwriting. It's not going to be, I can try to copy yours. It's never going to be yours.
Right.
That's a good thing. You don't want to have Bart's handwriting.
You really don't. Hey, how did you know he was talking to me?
You know, you don't want to be like, you know, like forging, you know, identity, you know, you want to be yourself. Here's one of the people in the chat here, Kevin Lehman. He's like, we've worked together. He's one of my students. He lives in Denver. Yep. You have to love the process of learning and improving. Absolutely so. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Kevin's a really great example of that. He's a wonderful player and, you know,
smart
dude, hardworking man. And, you know, he's interested always in improving. And he understands that it's a process. That's what it's about, you know.
Yep.
Kevin's been
a guest on our show before. He's a terrific drummer and a great, great educator.
Yeah, he's a cool guy, you know. Great guy.
We're both I'm from the Denver area too. That's where I grew up. But, and it was a small world. After he came on the show, he realized that my cousin was his babysitter when he was a little kid. I was like, what? That's crazy. How does one go about getting in touch with David Garibaldi if they want to take a lesson?
Yeah.
You can.
I might be asking for myself. I might not. I don't know.
I'm asking for a friend.
For a friend of mine.
you can get a hold of me like through Facebook and that kind of thing. That's the best way to do it. And, you know, the initial contact. And then, you know, from there, we'll, you know, emails and phone numbers and that kind of thing, you know.
Cool. Now, I've got to ask this question as a complete geeky guy on the road. Okay. maybe has nothing to do with drumming. Maybe it does. I don't know. Tower of Power is on the road, and you obviously have a drum tech and stuff like that. Do you guys do a sound check? Do you go in and tweak the drum set before the show, or have you been doing it so long you walk on the stage and throw down? How does that work? I have to know. Sorry, I'm geeking out now.
It's okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have great drum tech, Rich Russo.
Yeah.
From Tampa. He's a very badass individual. And but you know, I am hands on with all my stuff. And he's really good. I mean, he sets up the stuff and he can tune and he's a player and all this stuff. He's really, really an amazing guy. You know, but I like kind of to be involved in all of it. You know, I tune my stuff, you know, I retune things, you know, I always involved in my gear, you know, as far as sound checks go, we rehearse every show day, you know, have a sound check every show day.
Cool.
And those are, you know, that's a time for us to rehearse and to maybe work on new material and stuff. You know, Tower Power, man, is a hard working deal. You know, we have a pretty serious, you know, work ethic. You know, when we were all living here in the Bay Area, we used to rehearse every day. Mm-hmm. So we had our own rehearsal place in Berkeley. Then we moved over to Studio Instrument Rentals in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
And we would rehearse there every day. And we'd go on the road, come home the next day. Literally, we were in the rehearsal studio at 11 o'clock next morning, you know, hitting it, working on the music, developing things. And it's still like that. When we did our 50th anniversary show, wow, that probably was the hardest that I ever worked as a member of Tower Power, because we were working really hard touring, and we had all this material to learn. And so we used our sound checks as rehearsal time. We had a week of dedicated rehearsals in Sacramento. Then we started hitting it on the road. Every day we'd work on songs that were going to be in the 50th show. And then we would implement those into the set after we would get them all worked up the way we wanted. And we did that from, I think, January or February all the way till June.
Wow.
And,
wow.
You know, so that we were ready for the 50th show, which was a big deal. It was going to be recorded and all that stuff, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And, so then when we got down to the days before, I think the 2 days before, we had a rehearsal, two or three days rehearsal in Oakland at Tony's studio.
Mm-hmm.
And a big dress rehearsal with everybody. Then we got over to the theater. We had another big dress rehearsal with the strings and everybody else, you know. And by the time we got to Saturday, which it was a two-night gig, by the time we got to Saturday, man, we were just absolutely blithering, you know, exhausted, you know. So, but it was cool. So, yes, we sound check. Yes, we're involved in all the stuff that we're doing.
Cool.
You know.
I'm so happy to hear that. I love hearing that.
Dave, we're getting close to the end here, but I wanted to ask you real quick about stick people.
Yeah.
But you referenced that before. I know we've had Mike Clark on the show. He's a good friend. And you've had Jack DeJohnette recently, amazing, one of the best of all time. Tell us about stick people. What is it? And what do people do about how they engage?
Stick people is kind of our little, that was our pandemic, you know, group that we met three times a week during the pandemic. I think Mike Clark was the one that said he wanted us all to get together about, for some reason. And when we got together and we realized that how cool it was, we started doing it kind of as a way to help ourselves get through, you know, the pandemic. So Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, we would get together and just bullshit and talk about all kinds of different stuff. And it was therapeutic.
Nice.
And that, you know, then we decided, okay, well, let's bring people on here. Let's get a name, you know, like let's come up with a name.
Yeah.
We came up with Stick People, and then we started, you know, having people on with us. Then we got a producer, Mike Charlash, who is really a very, very bad man, skilled like you wouldn't believe in marketing, and he's a player himself. And so he sort of organized it into something that was presentable. And so what you see, the finished work are, you know, those are his productions.
Mm-hmm.
And so we, you know, we just pick people that we enjoy and want to, you know, our friends, of course, and some we don't know, and, you know, just get together and talk about stuff. You know, Jack was one of the really cool ones. You know, they're all been really, really cool, but for some reason, you know, like Jack was just, we were all kind of idolized him and everything, you know, and had known about him since Charles Lloyd, you know, yeah. Forest Flower, you know, way back in the day. And that was kind of, all of us knew of him. And some of us actually knew him from that period. And of course, Lenny with Bitches Brew and all this stuff, you know.
Is there a website that people can check stuff out, or is it all on Facebook?
There's a YouTube channel. There's, you know, Facebook, all that stuff, you know.
Okay.
That kind of thing. Cool. So we got about 10 of them out there now, you know, Jack being the latest one.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's funny when you tell that story, it just reminds me of what we did. This was our COVID project also.
Exactly. This thing that we're doing right now.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. COVID.
And yeah. This is what, show 115, right?
Yeah, 113. Yeah. So we've done it once a week for about, I don't know, whatever it is, 113 weeks.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
But we were also, you know, we were all sort of just twiddling our thumbs and learning how to do home recording and,
and we, like everybody else. Yeah.
Right. Right. And we missed the hang at the music store and talking about drums and teaching, and let's get together and start talking about stuff and having guests on. So
yeah,
similar thing. Well, listen, man, thank you. So, oh, I almost forgot. We have to give away a couple of copies of your new book, DG's Notebook.
Oh, and don't forget, these Dave's books are available on Hudson Digital Music.
Yes.
Yes. And yeah.
Hudson.
I'm sure hard copy also.
Hey, you know, regarding all that stuff, you know, we have I'm putting together a loop package that's going to be coming out soon.
Oh, really?
Cool.
Yeah. Oh, nice.
And then there's also, there will be updates to the book at some point as well. So
very awesome. Cool.
Dave, is that going to be on Hudson Music as well? The loops,
everything.
Yeah, Hudson. It's the place. It's the
Robbie's. Resort. Robbie's the man.
Robbie.
Yeah, he's been on the show. Great guy.
So Bart, you want to pick a couple of winners for a digital copy of DG's Notebook today?
Sure. The first one.
You can't pick Rob Wallace, by the way.
Well, the first one. You know what? Just so happens Bart Robley.
Yeah.
You know what? I'm gonna go with Jim Royal.
Oh yeah.
Jim is going out to Connecticut, and you know what? We're gonna send one back to my hometown of Colorado with our good friend Jacob Sosa.
Right.
Jacob.
There we go, Jacob.
Yeah. Congratulations.
And
guys, just send me your emails. I think I have both your emails.
Hey, you know who lives in Denver? Daryl Woolfolk plays with Gladys Knight.
Oh yeah. Yes. Very cool. Yeah, you know what, man? I miss Denver so much, but I don't miss dealing with the snow. Hey, you know what? We haven't asked this question in a while. It used to be the last question we always asked.
Here we go.
And the last couple we have it. And David, I we're going to totally put you on the spot. This is the most important question. It's a pretty tough one too. Mm-hmm. Okay, so just get ready for this. Where do you live? What exact town?
Livermore, California.
Livermore, California. In Livermore, California, or surrounding areas. You ready? Where do you get the best pizza?
Where do you get the best pizza?
Yeah, tough one. I told you.
He's more interested in having you figure out where your best pizza comes from.
Exactly. Totally That's right. Cool. Backfired.
Well, there's a place called Pizza Roma. It's like not far from my house, And the guy is Italian. His name is Matteo, and he makes really fabulous, you know, like pizza here in Livermore. But my wife, who is an Italiana, she's from Italy. She makes pretty good pizza herself.
Awesome. Awesome. Good answer. Good answer.
Why go out for burgers when you can have steak at home?
You guys ever get up to Zachary's in Berkeley or in Oakland?
No.
Oh, that's a good
spot. I don't know it.
Okay.
It's good.
It's really good. It's really good. Yeah. Next time you come up, I'll take you out.
Sounds good.
Dave, thank you for coming on the show. I think some of the best lessons are just the concepts. And I feel like I just got the best drum lesson.
Yeah, man.
You guys are really fantastic. Thanks, guys. It's been a pleasure and a privilege to be with you today.
This is ours, man. Thank you so much for sharing all your great wisdom and experience. And we got so much out of it. And I'm sure our viewers did too. Thank you. And good luck with everything, the tour, the books. We'll check back with you again soon.
Sounds good, fellas. Have a great one.
Awesome.
God bless you.
Thanks, Dave.
Thank you so much, David.